Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:59 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is June 23rd. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Something that David used to say really stuck in my head today, which is that monetary conditions beat most other factors most of the time. And I think that's something that we do need to pay attention to because monetary conditions are tightening. So despite the fact that we have these strong markets, particularly driven by artificial intelligence, we have to remember that monetary conditions are tightening. Now, I thought we'd kick off with this world interest rate probability monitor, because it's ascribing a nearly 70% chance that interest rates are going to rise again in both the USA and Canada, 90% for the EU, 183% for the UK, 129% for Sweden, 70% for Switzerland, 28% for Australia, and then it drops down to about 14% for Japan and India. And we're in this environment where we have synchronized tightening. Just this week, the Bank of England raised rates by 50 basis points. So did the Norges Bank in Norway. The Swiss raised rates by 25 basis points. So we have this pace of tightening that persists. There's a lot of fears out there about inflation. Now, I think these are important factors because we have to also remember that interest rates have gone up a lot already, and then they act with a long and variable lag. So this is something that we should be paying attention to. Now, there's a couple of different ways that we can look at this. So, on the one hand, you have the yield curve spread, and it is down to negative 100 basis points. So, this is a new monthly low, and now we have to just bear in mind that the last time it was down at these levels was in the early 1980s, and there was a quite deep recession at the beginning of the 1980s because they really got serious about trying to combat inflation. And let's just remember that that's what happened back in the late 1970s. We'd been through a decade of time where inflation persisted through a recession, which coined the phrase stagflation, which basically meant that you could have high unemployment and high inflation at the same time. And obviously that was problematic, and it was driven, I think, in large part by the oil shocks. So obviously that was seriously problematic. So then a lot of people are willing to bet that on the one hand, that either inflation is inconsequential because it hasn't contributed to a big rise in unemployment just yet, and that stock markets are still quite firm, so maybe it's not that problematic. And by the way, don't we have this absolutely fantastic new theme, artificial intelligence, which is going to change all our lives for the better or potentially kill us all at the same time? There's obviously a lot of argument going on right now. But then we should think about the fact that one of the reasons why those high valuations have been ascribed to these tech companies is because investors are willing to bet that we are going to quickly go back to an abundant monetary environment where there will be a huge volume of new money created. So I think that's also something that we need to begin to think about. But let's just remember that there are three stages to an inversion of the yield curve. And now I know that I keep harping on about this, and I know I've repeated myself on several occasions, but it's no less relevant. And this is exactly the time in the cycle that we need to pay attention to the yield curve, because it's when you have a deep inversion. Amid an environment where stock prices are exceptionally firm, that is exactly the time when it is important to pay attention, because it is quite normal for markets to rally following an inversion, because investors cheer at the fact that the central bank is finally doing something about the inflationary risk, which is exactly where we are right now. Then they overshoot, which in fact is probably more accurate to say exactly where we are right now. The Bank of England is panicking. They raised interest rates by 50 basis points this week. That's a re-acceleration of the trend. They are really worried about the pace of wage growth and of companies raising prices. They're terrified of a wage price spiral, and now they're being forced into proactively combating it. And what that basically means is that they're going to push unemployment higher. And they're going then to pray that that is something that will bring down inflationary pressures by killing off demand in the economy. And the problem is, of course, that they're going to continue raising rates, but the chances are that they've probably already done enough because mortgage rates are leaping higher. And the big swell of people that took advantage of the stamp duty holiday in July, August of 2021, they're all going to refix in the next 6 weeks. So that's a big swathe of the population who are going to see their outgoings multiply higher and without a big jump in their wages. So that's obviously going to have a knock-on effect in terms of purchasing power. When we think then about why are markets in the USA still going upwards? Well, it's because we're still in this environment where interest rates are rising, inflationary pressures have been a bit sticky, but we haven't had a knock-on impact on unemployment just yet. What we do know is that defaults are rising. We know that inevitably that will have a knock-on effect for high yield, but it's not happening just yet. The Federal Reserve is in a very tight position. They really do need to get inflationary pressures under control. The reason that those stock prices are high is because people don't believe that they're willing to do what's necessary to get inflation back down. I'm willing to take the other side of that trade at the present moment because I believe it is consensus. In fact, I have seen huge numbers of noted analysts promoting the idea that the USA is going to embark upon yield curve control. Now, what that basically means is that they're going to print the money necessary and that it's going to have an impact on the appetite for the US government debt, which would push yields higher, and the Fed would have to then intervene and stop the yield from moving higher. There's no doubt that yields have moved a lot, but it's also particularly relevant that the yield peaked at the end of last year, and we still have more or less a sequence of lower rally highs. And they were down 6 basis points in here today, down 10 in early trading. So I think that it is more likely than not that we're going to see yields compress from here. When we think about the dollar as and its reserve currency status, this is integrally attached to the argument about the yield curve control and whether that is going to be a viable scenario. But the only way that we're going to get yield curve control is if bond yields stay stubbornly high. If bond yields start to come back down, a lot of the pressure on the interest rate expense of the national debt will basically evaporate. And that's also then going to create a buying opportunity that a lot of the debt that's sitting on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve will start to look a lot better, and they'll start to be able to remit money back to the Treasury as well. So a lot is riding on bringing yields back down, but it's going to necessitate a growth scare. Now, when we look at the consistency of the trend, the yield continues to hold in the region of the 200-day moving average. and we have a sequence of ranges one above the other, and the lower side of the current range is at the upper side of the underline. So if we see the yield breaking back down through 3.5%, then that's going to greatly enhance the potential that the yield is going to compress back down to 2.5%. And then let's just remember what's happened in other times of quantitative tightening. So first, let's look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet. The point that I had been making back in March was that there was a lot of people talking about that this was the end of quantitative tightening. What I was thinking at the time was that it was more likely it was going to be an analog of what happened in the UK. The UK has had their pension leverage crisis. The Bank of England intervened, made basically unlimited cash available, allowed those pensions to meet the margin call, unwind a lot of the leverage, and then immediately got straight back to contracting the size of their balance sheet. Now, when we saw several regional banks go bust in March of this year in the USA, the Federal Reserve intervened, made unlimited cash available, guaranteed all deposits everywhere, basically reinstilled confidence in the banking sector to a greater or lesser extent, and then got straight back to their quantitative tightening program. So over the last year, they have taken approximately 700 billion out of circulation. Now, in terms of percentages, that's not an awful lot, but it is roughly equivalent to how much they took out in 2018 and 19. And we have plenty of examples of people being really worried about deflation in 2018 and 19, particularly in 2019. There was that magazine cover where there was the inflation dinosaur has finally gone extinct. And people really didn't think that inflation would ever come back. So obviously, people have been disabused of that notion. What we can definitely say then is that there is growing evidence that quantitative easing contributes to asset price inflation. We've seen lots of evidence of that. Whenever they embark upon quantitative easing, then we see asset prices appreciate. We see stock prices go up, bond prices go up. We've seen property prices rise, crypto prices rise. And in fact, I would say that Bitcoin is one of the primary liquidity barometers. So the fact that it is strengthening, that is, I don't believe on this occasion it is purely about liquidity, but more at the moment around limited supply and new sources of demand coming into the market. But if quantitative easing is contributing to asset price inflation, then quantitative tightening contributes to asset price deflation. Now, let's just pay attention to what happened to treasury yields between 2018 and late 2019, because what we had was exactly what happened in the EU. Yields go up first, so yields went up in 2018 and then they collapsed, and then in 2020 they really collapsed. Now, the other time that we've seen quantitative tightening was in the EU. So the size of the Fed of the ECB's balance sheet is still contracting, and they've taken about 1.3 trillion euro out of circulation. So when we think about then, why has the dollar been weak? Well, it's basically because the ECB's process of quantitative tightening has been twice as fast as that of the Federal Reserve. So the Fed has raised rates faster, and the ECB has been reducing the availability of euro in a very aggressive manner. But let's just go back then and look at what happened in 2012 through 14. They took a trillion out of circulation, which was effectively a halving Or excuse me, it was taking a third out, but it took out everything that they put in. So from the middle of 2012 through to the end of 2014, if we look at bund yields, we're going to see exactly the same thing. So initially in 2012, yields started to go up, and then by the time we get into the end of 2014 and into the beginning of 2015, yields collapsed. So now let's just look at bund yields today. We've seen that 1.3 trillion has been taken off the ECB's balance sheet, and this looks like a type 2 top formation. So we have the very well-defined base formation, a sequence of higher reaction lows, a little first step above the base, then a real acceleration away from the base, a bigger reaction, subsequently a big move on the upside, failed upside break, loss of momentum. The sequence of higher reaction lows is intact, but we certainly have the wedging characteristic. What that implies is we should be at least considering the potential that there is going to be a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and that with quantitative tightening underway, that what we should be anticipating is that bonds are going to rally and do so in a very profound manner. And that will be in response to recessions. And Germany is in a recession. The UK is likely to be in a recession. And we still have bond yields in the UK that are very strong, but the 10-year at least has not broken out. The 2-year has broken out. We have inverted yield curves in lots of different countries now. It's not simply the USA. So if monetary measures trump most other factors most of the time, well then monetary measures are really problematic right now. Now, are they likely to get more problematic? I think that's also something that we should be paying attention to. So the size of the money supply in the USA has peaked. But of course, it also accelerated. So it went from around 15 trillion up to almost 22 trillion in the space of about 2 years. And now it's started to come back down. Now, this is the biggest decline in the money supply ever. But of course, it's following the biggest increase in the money supply ever. And this is just a graphic representation of just how much money there is that is still sloshing around. So the fact that we haven't had a big knock-on effect yet in Wall Street is perhaps not that surprising, because when you have that volume of cash sloshing around, it takes time to bring it back down. So when we then think about the year-over-year change in money supply, it is contracting. It's down now to negative 4.6%, but of course, that is simply a function of just how high it was in the first place. But then we should also just now all pay attention to what's happening with the velocity of money, because it is looking increasingly likely that this is a good sized reversion towards the mean. Now, the velocity of money has been trending downwards since the late 1990s. And I think there are two primary factors that have contributed to that, which are technology and globalization. With the invention of the internet, we had a really significant change where we could do more with less. And the big buzzword of the internet era in the 1990s was disintermediation. And what it effectively did was get rid of the middlemen. And that has then sparked new technologies, new sectors. We've then had the telecommunications revolution, where the evolution of 4G was what allowed internet on a mobile device. And then there's an entire industry has ballooned around that. Now, if that was one of the contributing factors in the lower velocity of money, shouldn't we also start to think then about the potential that we're also going to have a deflationary impact from artificial intelligence? If you can now write a paper or an academic article faster, or just simply use it as a draft. And I think this is the primary use of artificial intelligence at present. It's useful for writing drafts for whatever one might be working on that is available online. Now, personally, I haven't used it for writing comment of the day, and I did play with it, but I didn't like the kind of interpretations that I was getting from it because they were too balanced. They were trying to be equanimous and not and attempting to avoid bringing making conclusions. And when you ask it to make a conclusion, it's usually the wrong one. If what you're trying to do is to identify where the crowd is going, well, then artificial intelligence is going to be contributing to that. If you're trying to identify how far has the crowd gone and when is it likely to turn, I don't believe that artificial intelligence is quite there yet. But if it is going to be a major part of the global economy, which appears likely, then we should anticipate that there will be a deflationary impact. And that would suggest that the velocity of money is unlikely to break this trend. But from a monetary supply and measure, or I guess management position, when the velocity of money goes up, money supply must go down. So you need less money in the system to promote economic growth if velocity of money is going up. And of course, with inflation, the primary impact of inflation is that people accelerate their purchasing decisions. They make the purchase today because they're worried that the price will be higher later. And that increases the velocity of money. But it also then contracts money supply, which contributes to quantitative tightening. And that also will then have an impact on the wider economy, because it will. If we're thinking about velocity of money, then it helps to inflate sales data and it allows companies the luxury of raising their prices. But those trends are not infinite and they rely on real wages rising. If real wages continue to fail to keep up with inflationary pressures, then the ability of companies to continue to raise their prices will obviously be impeded. So I think that as we look at where we have both push and pull factors for inflation. We obviously have had a shock in terms of the pandemic, and it has changed how people live their lives. And most particularly, it has changed how people spend their money and save their money. But those are potentially temporary. Whereas artificial intelligence as a technological innovation is permanent. And the biggest characteristic that is compelling about artificial intelligence is that you only have to teach it once. And that is an exponential growth curve. So it's been going on for years, and it was very slow. And now there are artificial intelligence programs that can label items. So if it can label items itself, then it's going to greatly enhance the learning proposition. And of course, any system that you train is going to be impacted by the quality of the data that it is trained on. So, there are obviously going to be better results from artificial intelligence programs that are trained on scientific raw data that is reliable. And Obviously, we can anticipate that there are going to be errors in subjective data, but it is quite likely to contribute to a longer term deflationary impact. So I think we've had an enormous sell-off in bonds. And I think that as we look at inverted yield curves proliferating everywhere, then it is something that we need to pay attention to. Now, high yield spreads continue to steady here around the 500 basis point level. Now, we also know that it is when spreads trend up and through that 500 basis point level that is usually coinciding with problems in the stock market. The fact that we had the initial pop on the upside last year and then subsequently they went sideways has, I think, lulled people into a false sense of security. That spread chart is not updated every day. It's updated with a 24-hour lag. And now if we look at the absolute price of the high-yield corporate debt, it is encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And this doesn't look like a particularly bullish chart. If it breaks the sequence of higher reaction lows, it could easily break downwards to new lows. Now, of course, the longer that interest rates stay high, the more pressure it's going to put on highly levered borrowers. And we know that there are significant issues with commercial property, and the vacancy rates in big cities is quite high. Then you also have this looming issue of UK regulations that are going to force the property owners to greatly enhance the energy efficiency of their buildings, and that is going to be a very expensive retrofit. So potentially the companies that are selling double glazed windows are going to be in a very profitable business for the next several years if those regulations stay in effect. Now let's then also just think about what's happening in terms of currencies. So the dollar index was a little steadier in here today, and we're in an interesting situation. In an inflationary period, you get countries basically competing to try and appreciate their currencies because it helps to reduce the cost of imports and helps to bring down, and then it makes the country less competitive at the same time. It weighs on the ability of consumers to spend. But now we're in a tricky situation where some countries are still raising rates, others are experiencing recessions already. And then, of course, you have other countries that have succeeded in killing off inflation, and they're seeing that they need to now start stimulating. So we're in one of the most variable periods for global interest rates that we've had in quite some time. So the dollar index is mostly dollar euro, and with Germany now in a recession, then it is likely that that will take some of the impetus out of the euro. When we think about the fact that the Bank of England raised interest rates by 50 basis points in a surprise move this week, it did not favor the pound, and the pound is pausing here in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But then let's just go back and think about the dollar index. And maybe it might be better to look at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, where it has less weighting of euro and more currencies. And we can get quite a lot of back history. That was a massive failed upside break in 2022, and the index has pulled back into the underlying range. I think that it is likely eventually the Federal Reserve will cut rates, and that we will see a monetary response. and that there will be more money printed. Now, when we think about what that means, every time they've tried quantitative tightening, then subsequently the size of the balance sheet has multiplied. Now, the last time they did that, we got inflation as a result of it, because we had both combined monetary and fiscal stimulus that were record in size. So the next time out, when there is a recession and interest rates do come down and the size of the balance sheet expands in order to deal with the problems, in order to ensure that inflation does not become a problem, they will then have to begin raising interest rates again soon, start reducing the size of the balance sheet quickly afterwards. If they do that, it will help to get inflation under control. And I think that is where the big argument about yield curve control runs aground. Because in order to get to the problem with debt that yield curve control would imply, you would have to have not just irresponsible, but continued irresponsible actions. And definitely, governments and central bankers, they did act irresponsibly in response to the pandemic, and people panicked, and then they left the assistance in the market for longer than was strictly required. They did not pay attention to the reality that most people were not getting very sick. And I think that more than anything was the factor that helped to drive inflation. Now, if we take what's happened with the pension issue in the UK and the regional banks in the USA, and the fact that they've gone straight back down to the knitting and the job of contracting the size of their balance sheets, to me at least, that gives me some basis for the view that when we do have a recession, that we're not going to see the same volume of assistance. And we've been through 12 years of this. We've been through 15 years of this. And I think people understand now that quantitative easing inflates asset prices, that quantitative tightening is going to create deflationary forces, and that this inflation becomes really problematic if it gets out of hand. So the experiment with modern monetary theory has ended. I think everybody now understands that it does create inflation, which was pretty obvious to begin with, and then subsequently that we have to just think about better ways of trying to get growth and monetary conditions under control. Now, when we think about the longer term, there are obviously problems with unfunded liabilities. There have been big promises made to the baby boomer generation that most countries are just not in a position to pay for. And obviously, some are in better condition than others. There was a statistic quoted in an interview with Stanley Druckenmiller over the last month, where he was basically talking about the efforts underway in France to try and raise the retirement age, because their deficit in terms of how much money they will need to set aside to provision for pensions is about 2% of GDP. And he said that it was about 8% in the USA, which would represent a tax rise that is exceptionally profound in nature and would probably kill off the economy at the same time. So then it basically means that there will be cuts to the kinds of programs that are on offer. It will be difficult to increase more programs, and that there will have to be some kind of change, and people will have to, or the social contract will have to be amended. And that's going to be difficult in an environment where we have a global economy and we also have artificial intelligence creating deflationary forces. But of course, deflationary forces from technology were one of the major contributing factors in the disinflationary environment we had for most of the last 15 years. But let's also now think about the outlook for globalization. And you cannot talk about globalization without talking about China. And China's economy ballooned in size after accession to the WTO in 2000. And now, and I think this is just an interesting graphic, just looking at clean energy metals. When it comes to processing clean energy metals, then China controls 40% of the processing of copper, 35% nickel, 65% of cobalt, 87% of rare earth metals, and 58% of lithium. Now, that is despite the fact that it isn't a major producer of copper, nickel, cobalt, or lithium, and the only one that it has a monopoly on, and the production of at least, is rare earth metals. So there are two factors that are worth considering. The first is that that desire or that willingness to host processing facilities for all of that ore was in service to the growth of the domestic manufacturing sector, the infrastructure sector, and the property sector. And then on top of that, it was strategic in nature, that by controlling the processing of the metals, then they would be in a stronger position to then control the production of products that are higher up the value chain, which is pretty much exactly what has happened. But now we have to also think about China's willingness to promote or to stimulate the economy. So they're not stimulating. And we have seen some interest rate cuts. We've seen modest efforts to support the economy, but the CSI 300 is still trending downwards, and it's been in a downtrend now for more than 2 years. The H-share index in Hong Kong is pulling back from the 200-day moving average in really quite a dynamic manner this week. So we're still in a downtrend for Chinese assets. And then we should pay attention to the renminbi because it's still right in the region of its lows and hasn't it, and we are the Dragon Boat Festival is the is these is Thursday and Friday this week, so we're not going to get prices for China today, but we're right in the region of the 7.2 level, which is where the price has found support in the past. Now, I do think that China will eventually begin to stimulate, and they're not going to allow all of these property developers to go bust. And they do need to come up with a way of funding the local governments. And the way that they funded them in the past is with property sales. So they're going to have to find a way to, for the central government to help to fund the local governments without using property as an intermediary force. Now, what that would mean is property taxes, or it would mean much higher sales taxes, and or it would mean an ability to tax the locals with local taxes. Any one of those is obviously going to be problematic, but it is totally necessary. And we're also in a situation where there's a growing trend among young people in China that they do not want to have children. There's a trend at the moment where lots of young people are adopting plush toys, their little plush orangutan toys from IKEA, dressing them up, taking them with them, taking photographs as if the plush toy is their child, and saying that's much easier to look after than a dog or a cat, and even obviously a lot less expensive than looking after a child. There's a growing trend of eating white people food, which is deemed to be salads and easy to prepare foods. This is all part of the lying flat movement. This is also contributing to deflationary forces. If China is not firing on all cylinders, if the Chinese consumer is pulling back and is not inspired to be a big consumer, well, then they're capable of exporting deflation. And that was one of the primary factors of globalization, that Chinese demand was a massive demand driver for commodities, but then it also helped to reduce the cost of everything else. Now, we're potentially coming off of that. And copper prices are starting to roll over. So we have a very clear Type 2 top formation in 2021 and 22. We had the big jump on the upside, the loss of momentum, the failed upside break, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and then a relatively lengthy period of right-hand extension. And prices have been rangy over the course of the last year, and there are very big arguments. The first argument is that demand for copper is going to double because of all of the EVs that are going to get built and all of that renewable energy infrastructure. And the other side of it is that how can the demand for copper double when it's practically impossible to build a new mine? So those growth rates are either going to be too ambitious or it's going to take a lot longer to do than people are thinking. But all of that doesn't take into account that China's property market is potentially crashing. And if they're going to avoid a crash, then they're going to try and avoid reflating the bubble too. So that is obviously going to be problematic in terms of demand. And China's control of the global copper market is profound. And the thing that I think most people don't pay attention to is that demand is not a constant. It's not nearly as volatile as supply, but it is not a constant, and it can go down. So this is obviously then something that we do need to pay attention to. And then I think it's also worth considering what happened today with Siemens Energy. So the share had been trending higher in a steady and impressive manner since October of last year, and it collapsed in here today. And the proximate reason was because the demand for wind turbines isn't keeping up. And they're having problems with the reliability of those turbines. Now, that was the entire reason that they hived off the business in the first place, but they never told anybody about it. One thing that I think is very relevant is we've seen huge investment in renewable energy. And how much of that was about regulatory arbitrage? And how much of it was about actual efficiency gains and productivity growth. When we look at, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, just this week, Ford announced that they're going to draw down a $9 billion loan from the US government, and they're going to go off and build new battery factories. And would they do that if there were no reg if there wasn't a subsidy? If there wasn't clear regulations to support it? Would they do it? And how much of it is really going to gel with the regular consumer? I know I was buying a car a year ago. I drove some Teslas, and at the time, the Tesla cost about the same as a brand new vehicle. So I wasn't going to buy the electric vehicle, and I just did not feel like the build quality was worth the money. So obviously, there are lots of people made the decision to buy Teslas, and the share has rebounded in very emphatic fashion over the course of the last 6 months. Going from 100 to 256 is a big rebound, and now it is testing the sequence of lower rally highs, and the downtrend is still really quite intact. Now, the cost of shorting is kind of expensive. So you do have to be right. And not only do you have to be right, but you have to get your timing just right. And but the challenge here is that Tesla is probably going to be the winner from the electric vehicle sector, and all of the other EV companies are now adopting its charging or the same kind of charger that Tesla has invented. But is it worth its valuation? So I think these are some of the important characteristics. The thing that I find most particularly interesting right now is that we're in a tightening global monetary condition. The initial decline from the peak in December of 21 down to the lows, first in June, but then the absolute low in October, was 37%, and the rebound has been 46%. Now, just let's remember those, because the initial decline in the NASDAQ, and I did think that I had that in there, was 39%, and then the rebound, which really came all the way back up, was about 40. What have I got there? 43%. So this happened in a shorter period of time. It all basically happened inside of 2000. And now we have had this going on for more than a year already. But the size or the magnitude of the moves is pretty similar. So on a log scale chart, you're going to see it, but most definitely on a point and figure chart, the size of the decline and the subsequent rebound are going to be identical. And because it doesn't look at that time interval, and we have a very short-term overbought condition, and we have monetary conditions that are still tightening. So the valuations that we have on some of these very large companies are extraordinary, and the market cap to GDP ratio is up to really quite an extraordinary level. It's well in excess of where it was in 2000. But the eight large companies, the Fangman companies, relative to the total market cap, is still at new highs. So we have seen just a phenomenal rebound over the last 6 months. And when I was writing at the beginning of the year about what the surprises were, I was thinking that the biggest surprise would be that we would have a big rebound in the beginning of the year. Because the consensus at the time was that we would be down in the first half of the year and up in the second half. And what has in fact happened is that we are up in the first half. Now that does beg the question, are we going to be down in the second half? Because interest rates are still rising, and we've seen valuations increase really quite profoundly. And I think when we just pay it, just remember the fact that Nvidia, it's a wonderful company, and they have really had they've been right in they've been in the right place at the right time. But the price to sales ratio is at 40 times. So if they fired everybody, and this is going back to that's the CEO of Sun Microsystems, and he was talking about how ridiculous it was that the company was ascribed a price to sales ratio of 10. And he was basically saying that you would have to fire everyone and basically spend not one penny, and then it would take 10 years to buy back the value of the share with nothing happening to earnings over that time. And this is what has been priced into Nvidia. Now, there's potential that the data center build will have to increase. And it was a lot easier to build data centers when interest rates were zero. And then I think we have to think about who are the data center companies. So Amazon is a big data center company, and the share is also overbought. Now it has had a good size rebound, and it is back above the 1,000-day moving average. So now the question is, are we going to see support found in the region of the 200-day moving average? If monetary measures beat most other factors most of the time, then the potential for this to be the beginning of a new big bull market, I think, are quite low. I think it is much more likely that we're going to go through a period of volatility, then we will see some significant bargains coming through, and that the sector that is most likely to rally in the near term is going to be the bond market, and then also the cryptocurrency market. So Bitcoin was up another $700 in here today. It is bouncing emphatically from the region of the 200-day moving average. And we are less than a year out from the next halving. So that will further bolster the view that it's a limited supply environment. But the proximate reason for the big strength in crypto right now is that large investors are beginning, or large asset managers are beginning to get interested in launching ETFs. And as that asset gathering for an ETF launch increases, it's going to soak up the available supply. And we're talking about supply that is limited, and that there's a well-defined supply of Bitcoin out there. And as ETFs eventually do get permissioned, then that is going to increase the demand factor considerably. So it's really a supply and demand argument. I'm not getting into the philosophical arguments about the nature of money or the potential for fintech to conquer the banking sector. This is simply a supply and demand argument. And Ethereum is also steadying here and coming up towards that $2,000 level, which is the upper side of the base formation. And there's a well-defined sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of the last year. So it does look like we are now going to see greater interest coming through in the cryptocurrency markets. But of course, we're also starting to see renewed interest beginning to come through in gold. It's right now in the region of the 200-day moving average. It was up over $20 in early trading today and paired that advance. And I think primarily because the bond yield contraction also ebbed a little today. But if we're moving more towards a deflationary environment, that's positive for gold. And that because it will also enhance the potential that more money will be supplied. Now, I don't think that we're going to see the same volume of cash printed the next time round as last time. But if we're in a deflationary environment, it is positive for gold. We've seen real yields pop up to positive globally, and that generally acts as a headwind to gold, as those real yields move back to negative. And it is likely that we are going to move back into a negative real rate environment as the global economy slows down, because there will be stimulative measures introduced. Then that will be positive for gold, and we'll see it starting to move higher. With the size of the debts, even with the best will in the world to try and get them under control, it's a lot easier to manage debts when you have a mild inflationary environment. So there will be a monetary response. And the purchasing power of currencies is going to deteriorate further. And I think that is one of the primary factors that will contribute to gold doing well. At the moment, Bitcoin is outperforming, not because it's like digital gold or any other reason. It's simply the supply and demand argument that is focusing attention on it right now. I think that they're very different assets. They do not have a strong correlation, and they generally tend to go up for different reasons. But Bitcoin most particularly does well and really surges when monetary accommodation becomes a serious factor. And the fact that the halving has coincided with those kinds of events would suggest that in 2024, we can anticipate that there is going to be a lot of money printed. Then I think it is the question that nobody knows the answer to is how long that liquidity will actually remain in the system. But I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.